I want to cover quantum theory, some ideas about quantum theory, some perspectives on quantum theory in this course. A few different ways of thinking about quantum theory and different ways of doing calculations in quantum theory. Different ways in the end of thinking about applications of quantum theory. So we're going to start with non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which I think is familiar to most of you. And we're going to be interested throughout the course, really. We're going to keep coming back to this question of what we can say about the connections and the tensions between quantum mechanics and special relativity. So ultimately, those two things need a unified treatment. We need to go beyond non-relativistic quantum mechanics. We need to find a fully relativistic way of dealing with quantum theory. That will take you, although it will be beyond the scope of this course, that will take you towards relativistic quantum field theory. But even before one starts on that journey, there are a lot of conceptual issues, a lot of calculational issues that make one worry, and that one needs to one worry that it's going to be impossible to complete that journey, and one needs to clear a conceptual path. May I get straight to what extent non-relativistic quantum mechanics is non-relativistic, to what extent its superficial tensions and even apparent contradictions with special relativity can on proper understanding be eliminated. So tension, contradiction, we need to keep looking out for those and to try and find a path through those. There's a bigger picture to it still, of course. General relativity, about which you've already been hearing more this morning, and gravity, and one would like, in the end, to be able to find some coherent story that perhaps starts with non-relativistic quantum mechanics and appropriate limit, brings it together with special relativity, and then. Takes us to a further unification with gravity. So this is already beyond the scope of this course. This is way, way, way beyond the scope of this course. But still, I think we'll find thinking as carefully as we can about this area at least begins to highlight some possible ideas and some possible ways forward, and perhaps even some possible problems in unifying quantum theory and gravity. So how that unification pans out, I'm sure you know there are many intriguing research programs, but we don't know for sure. We do not have a complete unified theory. And there are different lines of thought on that. I don't really want to press any particular one of them, except that to stress again, the clearer we can get our conceptual understanding of quantum mechanics, the better shape we are to move forward to look at the rest of the unification program. So we're going to spend some time on conceptual, foundational questions. And I hope we'll see these cross-fertilize with calculational techniques. Each time you find a new way that's powerful and interesting to calculate things in quantum mechanics, you tend to find a new perspective on quantum theory. And you want to clarify what exactly that is. And there's in turn an interplay between both of those and applications of quantum theory. And although we're only going to touch on this a little bit in this course, the applications that I'm going to highlight are mostly in the realm of quantum theory and information. So quantum theory, quantum information, and also quantum interferometry as a way of probing quantum theory and probing things with quantum theory. So going back to this picture here, if I can just for a minute, most of the work on quantum theory, quantum information, has been pretty much explicitly taking non-relativistic quantum mechanics for granted. When people talk about quantum computers, their model of a quantum computer is one which doesn't need to talk about Minkowski space. It just needs to talk about standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics. When people talk about quantum cryptography, typically, almost always, at least until recently, the same has been true. The whole theory is based on non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But that's beginning to change. We're beginning to understand more and more that to understand the full power of quantum information, you need to take into account special relativity. This is still quite a young research area, but I want at least at the end of the course to highlight one or two examples of how we tie together these three concepts of quantum theory, relativity, and information in a useful way, a way that leads to applications that we can't do without all three. All three of those things. Okay, I wanted to mention a few background references. I've listed them on the first page. I would strongly urge you all to read Feynman's book and watch Feynman's lectures, particularly the lecture on quantum theory. I think they're just a marvelous introduction, not so much to the technicalities, but to how to think about science, how to think about the fundamentals of the subject. And we're lucky, we're in a very exciting time because there are new books and very much improved versions of old books coming out all the time. So there's a classic book by Feynman and Hibbs that's now been somewhat updated and corrected by Daniel Steyer, Quantum Mechanics and Path Integrals. There's another classic that's just got better and better, the Picture Book of Quantum Mechanics, which gives a lot of physical and calculational insight into quantum theory. And there's a marvelous book, in my opinion, on quantum theory from a mostly informational theoretic perspective that came out last year by Ben Schumacher and Michael Westmoreland. Those three in particular, I'd recommend you explore as much as you can. Okay, let's start with the familiar. Let's start with the Schrödinger equation. So, I think almost all of you have some familiarity with the Schrödinger equation for n particles. These are n particles with equal masses m. this is a potential which could be time dependent, could be time independent, that covers both the interactions between particles. So for instance, we can have potential terms that depend on the difference between the two vectors x1 and x2, and also the interaction with some external field. So we could have things that depend on the absolute value, for instance, of the xi. So our full potential could be a sum of terms like this and terms like this and other stuff. And in the one particle case, which I want to focus on for a while, we don't have to worry about self-interaction, so it reduces to this. And the Schrödinger equation is this form, sorry, fix this. A simple differential equation, single partial derivative with respect to time, double partial derivatives with respect to the space coordinates. Something we can, even if we don't have a full understanding of what it means, we could just play with mathematically and investigate the solutions of. I should say right from the start, I'm more than happy. I'd strongly encourage you to ask questions whenever I'm saying anything that's obscure that you don't understand. If I make a mistake, and it will happen, help me out, please. Move things forward. The more that we can turn these lectures as well as the tutorials into something more like a sort of research seminar or more with two-way interaction, the better. I might throw a few questions at you at some point. So be ready. Okay. So we have this beast. We can write psi for a single particle just as a function like this. And we, although we can attack it mathematically, we need at least some rules of thumb, some first start on quantum theory, some way of trying to make sense of what this is telling us physically. And that comes via the measurement postulate. So like most of the things we're doing, we're going to set out a first version of this, and we're going to come back to this later and try and refine it, try and see if there isn't a slightly subtler and more sophisticated way of understanding it. But let's start with the familiar. So the measurement postulate tells us if we have a physical system, its wave function at time t is given by psi of t, and we measure something, we find some quantity, energy, position, momentum. It gives us a rule for the probability distribution of the outcomes. And it tells us that the things we measure, the observables, correspond to some Hermitian operator, and part of our task as theorists is is to work out which Hermitian operators correspond to which observables. The possible outcomes of the measurement correspond to the list to the eigenvalues of the Hermitian operator. So these things have eigenvalues. Call them little ai. Possible outcomes given by those. And we have a probability distribution. So the probability of any particular outcome is given by the expectation value of the corresponding projector in the state psi. So that's the probability of outcome I. That one doesn't move? Yeah, okay. I'll leave that one there. So if we take something like this, which we're going to play with in a minute, this is here is a complex-valued wave function. Here's its real part. Here's its imaginary part. And we are interested in measuring, say, the position of the corresponding particle. Well, we need to find out what's the relevant operator. And in that case, it's simply the operator x. What are its eigenvalues? Well, so the eigenvalues are, let's call them points on the real line in one dimension. And the eigenfunctions, and there's something a little bit singular about this particular example, but let's just accept it for the moment. Eigenfunctions delta of x minus x zero. And the projection postulate tells us that the probability distribution for finding x at the point x zero is given by, sorry, I'll get my bearings on these boards in a minute. Well, it's given by, and here is our problem. We've got to project onto delta of x minus x zero. So we really need some extra justification for how to treat these continuous variables. But, and we see also for any particular point on the real line x zero, we expect the probability actually to be zero. So what we have is a probability density. And the probability of finding position in some interval is the finite quantity that we can calculate. Integral mod psi of x squared dx over the interval I. Has everybody seen this before? Is this all familiar? Is it puzzling to anybody? Okay. Okay. So we would. What's the best way of putting that? So the probability, given that the probability of outcome x0, let's call that p0, we can work out the expected value of a measurement of the position. Sorry, let me pause and times x. Yes, please.
Yeah, I have a question according to the position operator, because what is the Hilbert space it acts on? Because it is not the physical space, because the delta distributions are not eigenvectors
of the physical space. Right,
yeah.
Indeed.
So what is the relationship between the Hilbert space the position operator acts on and our normal Hilbert space? Is it a subset or what? I have never really understood.
Right. I wanted to avoid these technicalities. I may.
Which is not separate.
Let me try and think of the best way through this discussion. Sorry, I'm skipping too hastily. To answer your question, the mathematically rigorous way of treating this is to start with an ordinary Hilbert space, observe that we have operators that we're interested in but don't in fact have eigenstates in that Hilbert space, and then just extend the Hilbert space. And that leads, that can be done rigorously, but it's not something that I'm going to do rigorously in this course. I wanted to keep the discussion at an intuitive level. What is the best? So here we. Let's proceed through slightly different stages of rigor. We could define an indicator function. So instead of considering measurements of position, instead of considering an operator whose projections onto eigenstates take this form, and which has an infinite number of different eigenstates. Let's consider something that asks a slightly simpler question. Is the particle in this interval I or not? So you notice this thing is projection. And you notice it has two eigenvalues. Yes, it is in the interval. No, not in the interval. So we can ask of any wave function psi of x. Ask of. We can take a system described by any wave function psi of x. Ask, do we find the system, do we find the corresponding particle in the interval I? Well, if we break psi of x up into the sum of pi psi and 1 minus pi psi, you notice this is an eigenstate of pi with eigenvalue 1. And this is an eigenstate of pi with eigenvalue 0. So for instance, just check the second of those. Pi acting on 1 minus pi acting on psi gives us pi minus pi squared acting on psi. But pi is a projector, so that's pi minus pi acting on psi, which is 0. OK, so now we have a, we change the question. We have a simpler question. Not exactly where is the particle, but is its position in this particular interval or not? We have two possible answers. And the probability of getting the answer yes, according to the rule we started with, is given by the inner product of psi with pi on psi. Probability of no is 1 minus that. But now, what is this thing? This is simply integral of psi star of x, pi psi of x. And what does pi do? It has the same effect as multiplying psi by this step function over the interval. So this is the same thing as integrating over the interval, psi star of x, psi of x, dx, which gives us 1 psi of x squared dx integrated over the interval. So if we're willing to think now of measurements of position as things that we can approach, things that we can approximate by questions of this sort. And you can see how that would work. If you're really interested in whether the particle is precisely here at x0, well, you can start by asking, is it in this interval? And how about this, which is half the size, and this, and so on. You can think of it succession of intervals that converge to the point x0. And the corresponding probabilities for each of those finite intervals are finite numbers of this form. And so we end up with a result that's consistent with taking the probability density for finding the particle at x0. To be mod size 0 x squared. Another way of putting that, which is maybe more helpful, probability of finding it between x0 and x0 plus dx0 is mod size of x0 squared dx0. Well, you can think of this two ways around. If you take this rule, then you recover all the equations all the expressions we derive for the probability of finding any interval I. The other way around to think about it is, as the interval I gets smaller and smaller until it converges on this interval, well, we're really integrating mod psi of x squared over a smaller and smaller range. So from x0 to x0 plus dx0. And if psi is a reasonably well-behaved function, then it's going to change rather little as dx0 gets small. And so this integral becomes basically just a constant psi of x0 squared times dx0 plus lower order terms.
Adrian, can you actually go, because I can't read that.
Oh, you can't read that. I'm so sorry. No, thank you very much for telling me. Okay, I will try and do it twice the size. The probability density.
Yeah, it's that first line that one you just rubbed out then.
Is a particular problem. Okay.
Yeah.
So find the particle in x0, x0 plus dx0. Is that okay?
Perfect.
Is mod psi x0 squared dx0. Up to, in the limit as dx0 gets small. Okay, so so we have at least at this sort of rather superficial level of rigor, we have a rule for the probability of finding a particle at any given point, or at least in any small region. Here we have mod psi squared plotted in green. We see the probability is peaked here, small here, it's essentially zero over here. And we have a similar rule for measurements of momentum in momentum space. Now, there's still something unphysical about these definitions, if you really, really press on them. We sort of went through this trek because we were unconvinced, at least, that it actually made sense to talk about measuring the position of a particle precisely at a point. Mathematically, we're unconvinced because it gives us an eigenvector that is unnormalizable, an eigenstate, it's unnormalizable, delta of x there is like zero. Physically, we're unconvinced because if you think about it, you could imagine trying to measure the position of a particle more and more precisely, But it's hard to understand what it could possibly mean, how one could possibly go about identifying with absolute precision the position of a particle. But if that's true, if we can't pin down the position of a particle precisely, it's at least a serious worry that nor are we going to be able to measure with absolute certainty whether the particle is precisely in some interval between x0 and x1 or not. We expect some sort of blurriness at the edges here. Certainly, if you think physically about how you'd go about measuring the position of a particle, what does one do? You take something like a film, and you get a spot on the film. That's to a certain resolution, that tells you the position. But then if you look at the spot and magnify it up, in the end, the spot is some collection of atoms and molecules that have been excited and moved from one state to another. So it's a slightly fuzzy thing. And it might in the end be consistent with a particle having hit it here or here, or depending on exactly how these things propagate, maybe even here at the edge. What it isn't doing is giving up either a precise reading of the position or even a precise interval in which the particle has quite definitely been confined. Apart from anything else, the spot itself is built up of atoms and molecules which themselves follow the laws of quantum theory, and so their own positions are uncertain. So, we should keep at the back of our minds that this could matter sometimes, that we, in the real world, will not be able to implement even these interval-based measurements of position or momentum. At the same time, they're mathematically very convenient, and normally you don't go very far wrong by using them as idealizations. If it turns out that they're important, well, then you better analyze in more detail what your measuring device is. In the case of the film, you'd better look at exactly how the interactions between the particle and the development process are taking place. Well, okay, you can do that. For the moment, I want to stick with the idealized definitions and see what intuitions we can develop from those. Okay. We can take the Schrödinger equation and we can run with it. We can just plug it into a program and look at solutions. It's easiest to do that in one dimension, certainly easiest to picture them in one dimension. But most of what I'm about to say actually goes fairly straightforwardly across to three dimensions. So, one can start. You can start with something reasonably simple, and either mathematically or simply by brute force programming, follow what its Schrödinger evolution is. Let's do that. Well, I'm going to need a normalization factor. So suppose we try this. You'll notice at time zero, we've chosen things so that we have a completely real valued wave function. Maybe that will make things simpler, we'll see. And we want the idea of something like a particle confined to a region, but in a reasonably smooth way. So we're going to choose it to be a Gaussian, and it's a Gaussian of a width which we can parameterize by lambda. and this one. Okay, you'll notice three curves are moving there. The real part is in red, the imaginary part in blue. And the one that gives most sort of physical insight, I guess, is modulus of psi squared in green. And what we're seeing is that we keep a Gaussian form, we keep the same center at zero, but we get a spread over time. You can work out, you could do the calculation algebraically rather than numerically. How many people are familiar with that and how many are not? Can I get some idea? Who has played with Gaussian wave packets before? Maybe half? Who hasn't? Because there's always this sort of, yeah, it never adds up to 100%, but okay. maybe we can add a tutorial problem about that. Let's just explore numerically a few more Gaussians. What happens if you try and start the thing off in a state which has a non-zero expected value of momentum? Again, focus on the, if you have to focus on one line, focus on the green one. So we're getting, intuitively quite appealing picture here. What's happening is that the center is now moving, and it's moving with constant momentum. The Gaussian is still spreading. We can calculate the spread. And we still have this sort of picture of single quantum particles as things, at least if we focus on psi x squared, things that sort of behave a little bit like this. They spread, and maybe sometimes they contract, although we haven't seen it yet. They're capable of moving. But so far, they're sort of keeping some sort of mathematical structure. It's interesting to explore that further. That is, no, not that one. Okay, actually, I'm going to skip that. Okay, never mind. This is the Gaussian evolving in a rather weak potential. So now we have a non-zero V of x, it's given by minus f dot x. The value of x is rather small, 0.02. And you can see, let's try that again. You can see that the center is moving, there it goes. You might just about believe that its movement is getting faster over time, but it's easier to see with a slightly stronger potential. So here, instead of 0.02, we have 0.2, and now if you look at the center of mod psi of x squared, it's very clearly accelerating over time. Let me run that again just to persuade you. So it's hardly moving at this point, and now it's picking up speed. Look. What? What we're building up so far is some sort of idea about Gaussian wave packets. Well, in a zero potential, and then in a simple linear potential. Are we We can see what happens to the spread, and we can see what happens to the center of mass. Yeah.
Did the particle that near potential have like an initial velocity?
Thank you. It didn't, no. So.
Okay. So it's kind of slipping down the slide.
It's exactly. So here's the potential f of x. We're taking a quantum mechanical model, obviously, but what we're modeling is a classical system, which you could think of as a ball on this slope. You start it at the origin, you just release it, and if it were a classical thing, it would start with zero velocity, and it would gradually accelerate down the slope. And what we're seeing is that as far as the center of mass behavior is concerned, we actually get exactly the same. So the Gaussian wave packet in the linear potential at time t well, I can give you a general expression, but if we take the case I've just discussed, that's V0 equals 0. Behaves like this. And if we take it in zero potential, so no G, we just get this. And the spread is, in this case, 1 plus h bar squared t squared over m squared lambda squared. And that's actually the same in both cases. So one might conclude, might be tempted to start concluding a couple of things from this. One is that the center of mass of your Gaussian wave packets follows classical laws. That indeed turns out to be correct, and we'll see later why. Another is that life is relatively simple in quantum mechanics. You start with a Gaussian wave packet, you let it evolve, it'll carry on being a Gaussian wave packet. That I can give you some more evidence for, but be warned, that is far from correct. So I want to first make the point that it's a tempting conclusion from a few simple examples, and then give good reasons to reject it. Okay. I guess the obvious next step is to add an x squared term to the potential. And I have a little clip of that. Have we lost?
It's still there.
It's still there, but it's not there. That's odd. It's back. Don't know why. Okay. This is a rather brief clip, but you can here we have the x squared potential. You see that this slope here. And here we have a Gaussian wave packet bobbing around inside it. And you can see now it's spreading and contracting, but keeping its Gaussian shape all the time. Okay, so that's a little extra reason to be tempted into thinking life is always Gaussian. And here, let me start that again. As soon as we get beyond very simple potentials, they don't have to be time dependent, but even simple time independent potentials, for instance, here's a square one. We fire a Gaussian wave packet at it, we see things fall apart. It's roughly speaking, it's breaking into two components. One's going through the potential, one's being reflected. And if you look at them, they haven't really split into many pieces, but they're very far from being Gaussian. What do I want to draw from this? First, that there is some use to the idea, the notion of a wave packet, the notion of something that if it's not exactly Gaussian, it's sort of approximately Gaussian. When we think of what's going on in an experiment, even if we've got a beam and we've split into several beams, it's often a helpful insight to try and think, well, we've got something like this, the Gaussian wave packet's coming in and maybe it's split into a superposition of something that's roughly Gaussian and something that's roughly Gaussian. And maybe we're gonna bounce these off mirrors, recombine them. But if you're thinking of the behavior of the Schrodinger equation solution through the experiment, it's worth keeping in mind. I mean, it may be useful to model each individual beam by Gaussian wave packets. But second, we're gonna have to quickly get to grips with something much more complicated. And as long as we were dealing with these things, it's a bit of a stretch. It's almost literally a bit of a stretch because of the way these things are. Yeah. But we could sort of think that quantum physics is not, it's a little bit non-classical, but it's not very far away from classical physics, really. We just have to take the idea that we have a particle and, well, it's a sort of extended object rather than a point-like thing. And it's a stretchy extended object. That model gets you a little way, but not very far. And since most of the interesting quantum physics involves things interacting with other things, firing something at a non-trivial potential, we're going to have to think about what theory and experiment are actually telling us. How am I doing for time? We're 15 or 20 minutes. Okay. I will come back to the harmonic oscillator, which is sort of roughly at the next point in the notes next time, and press ahead this time a little bit more on this this attempt to get to grips with quantum theory and what it could be telling us. So let's notice something else here. Let me go back to the Gaussian and the linear potential. There we go. It's accelerating. The center of mass, the bulk of the distribution is moving faster and faster. And there's no limit, at least in our equations, to that speed. We can start out with something at rest, put it in something like a gravitational potential, and as long as it's allowed to accelerate and in this uniform potential, it will do so. In particular, we could start out with something at rest, feel happy that special relativity isn't going to be a problem, and yet once we apply this potential, the speed can accelerate well up to beyond the speed of light. And that shouldn't be a surprise. The Schrodinger equation had nothing to do with the speed of light. We have no C in the Schrodinger equation. So we have an obvious reason to think that there's a conflict between the Schrodinger equation and special relativity. And indeed, There is. That's a perfectly good reason. Another one is that the Schrodinger equation itself is just obviously non-relativistic. As a, if you remember, we wrote down a while ago, we had this, and this is a first order differential in time. And this second order differential in space. Coordinates. And the Lorentz transformations are linear in space and time. So any equation that we think is even a candidate for being Lorentz invariant ought not to mix second order derivatives in x with first order derivatives in time. We apply a transformation and suddenly we're going to find second order derivatives in time, first order derivatives in x. There's really no chance of covariance here. So this is sort of manifestly non-Lorentz invariant. So there's an obvious task ahead of us, us if not in this course, in our efforts as theorists, to try and find a better equation. And that line of thought takes one towards exploring Lorentz covariant equations. It takes you to the Klein-Gordon equation, the Dirac equation, and then further beyond that to relativistic quantum field theories. It shouldn't be a surprise that we're going to find contradictions between our non-relativistic dynamical equation and special relativity. But there's another worry, maybe subtler worry, that we need to focus on, that we can already focus on in the non-relativistic context without exploring the Dirac equation and quantum field theory. And that is that the measurement postulate also looks, at first sight, as though it's in tension with, threatening, possibly contradicting our understanding of special relativity. Why so? Well, take something like this. We agreed that you could, for instance, at least to a good approximation, measure whether it's in this interval over here or not. Sometimes it will be. If it is, we've got to replace this whole complex valued wave function with which has this sort of Monsi squared, with something that is peaked, in fact contained, inside this interval. That isn't an argument that we've broken special relativity, but it looks at least at first sight concerning in several ways. Concern number one, we could carry out such a measurement on a system, and by doing so, affect the results of measurements that other people were carrying out somewhere else. If that's correct, then we can send them signals. We can either measure or not. Their results will be different depending whether we measure or not. If we do this at a particular time in the frame we're working in, well, they'll get the answer at the same time. And there's a second concern, which is it's harder to articulate precisely. We're going to have a go at it later. But for the moment, let me just try and articulate it roughly. The concern is something like this, that whatever the postulates of quantum mechanics exactly have told us, it's tempting to try and think of this wave function as saying something like that there's something physical spread out over the region where the wave function is non-zero. That's going beyond the quantum mechanical postulates, but nonetheless, it's a strong temptation. I don't think anybody who's first explored the Schrodinger equation hasn't at least tried to make that something like that idea work. And it's just, it may turn out to be an unsustainable idea, but it's not a prima facie stupid idea to think that there is some story about reality that underlies the mathematical psi of x. Well, if that were true, and never mind the details of this story for the moment, but if something like that were true, and we carry out a measurement over here, well, we're suddenly changing that whole story. We carry out a measurement, we find the particle here. As a result, the wave function now looks like this instead of that. And whatever the story about reality was all the way over here, it's suddenly and radically and instantaneously, according to the measurement postulate, changed. It was a story given by this curve, or if we take one side squared, or these oscillating things for the real and imaginary part. And it's now a story given by zero, because we found the particle over there. So as I said, it's hard to articulate this worry precisely, and you may decide right from the start. It's not possible to articulate it precisely, but it's not really a sensible worry. I think we're going to explore it in more detail. We're going to try and find sensible ways of articulating something like the intuition that underlies that worry, and then see if we, rather than rejecting it on principle, whether we could find ways of confronting it with experimental data and thereby understand whether or not what could be going on in nature in experiments where we carry out measurements at separated points. And in particular, whether there is some sort of story or could possibly be some story beneath quantum theory about what's going on in reality in such experiments. So that's a line of thought for the future. Does anybody have any questions on that? Because has anybody thought about this one way or the other? Have you thought about measurements and signaling? So you're saying yes, for instance. And in what context? With what conclusions?
The whole the wave collapse thing, it doesn't really. There isn't any way that you can think about how a wave packet could deform itself or something in an infinitesimal amount of time when you do a measurement.
If you think of, am I understanding right? If you think of the wave packet as a sort of real thing, it would have to be suddenly sort of snapping together instantaneously when you carry out a position measurement. And that looks as though whatever the real stuff that makes it up, the goo, is sort of moving at arbitrarily fast speeds.
You would have to have some way of communicating infinitely fast throughout this blob.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, that doesn't really make sense. I guess Yukir Aronoff says if you have the future and the past both affecting the particle, you can work that out, but that I can't visualize that in any way.
Okay, that's an interesting insight, though. There might be. be ways of addressing this that involve non-standard causality. That's more sophisticated than anything we're going to cover here. Okay, so you could... One possible conclusion is just... At least the naive version of this idea seems to be intrinsically non-relativistic. Let's throw it away. And that's something like the first thesis. Yeah, you.
If you consider like a wave function of two particles, then that suddenly lives in a six-dimensional space, right?
Right.
So just from that, it's obvious that the wave function isn't something that lives on a normal space.
It's correct. Thank you. That's good. I guess it's not so obvious that there is no story to be told about stuff in, say, 3D space that's associated with a wave function. For instance, you could still look at the something like the particle number density, no matter how many particles you have. But I'm glad for another reason you mentioned the two-particle case, because all the worries I've described, you might look at the one-particle case and say, well, I can eliminate those one by one. Any story you tell about relativity is any story you tell about reality associated with wave functions is going to contradict relativity pretty much straight off the bat, so let's reject it. And maybe with a bit of work, you can look at measurements of a single particle, measurements of the position of a single particle, and convince yourself that there's no way of sending signals by such measurements, and so that worry is eliminated. But, you certainly can do the second of those. But even if you do that, you've only just started on a journey, because you have to worry not just about measurements of position, but measurements of any variable, and not just for a single particle, but for a system of an arbitrary number of particles. And so we're going to need some systematic way of, in the end, of thinking about n-particle systems, measurements on n-particle systems, and the relationship of those with causality in order to finally resolve this little conundrum. Yeah.
So maybe I have a more experimental probably question.
Good.
So if you measure something, even better if you have a system of n particles, and you know that it would collapse your wave function, say, nearly instantaneously or instantaneously as in quantum mechanics, and there'd be a way to check it by doing the measurements, very fast. So you would be able to check whether the wave function has collapsed.
How would this work? You'd measure it, and then you very, very quickly do a second measurement.
Yeah, and check whether
it agrees with the first one.
Yeah.
And suppose, what do you expect will happen if we do that?
If it has collapsed, and you measure it fast enough, and hasn't gone out of the point, out of that state yet, you will get the same thing. And what I'm saying is, maybe not measure it even in the same light, spatially. Check whether the wave function collapses instantaneously by doing two measurements very fast. And you would need to make the measurements probably faster than that you could have propagation by the speed of light. You need the measurements done one place and the other faster than propagation.
We're going to look for the particle over here,
yeah.
And we're going to look for it over here at the same time.
Yeah.
And we're hoping to catch it out. We're hoping to catch it in both places at once because it hasn't had a chance to.
So you do the measurement, the wave function collapses, and you check whether you get the same. If you could get, the same wave function. It doesn't collapse to a single point. What I mean is to measure the wave function somehow spatially. Not necessarily not necessarily to the measurement on position or whatever. It's some measurement.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I haven't figured out what to measure yet. But
position would be a reasonable thing to start with. But
that's entanglement. Entanglement.
Just quick, so there was another question over there, but just quickly, what do you expect will happen if we do those?
I know that from this experiments with entanglement that you get collapse and faster than the light. I was wondering if it would be possible to,
You're not sure. Okay. Question over there. Question over here.
I'm just not understand why are we even talking about instantaneous measurements, because as far as I know, they don't exist. Any measurement is going to be an interaction which yields a certain position of the error. Any interaction is extended over time,
right,
and it slowly collapses over the time.
Slowly.
If you have that interaction be extended over a very short period of time, you won't get a definite result. You'll get a certain probability distribution that will be a little bit better than the wave function.
Okay. Thank you. You've put your finger on another place where we've idealized. It's a standard thing, standard idealization, but you're absolutely right. It is an idealization. The measurement postulate just says if you carry out a measurement at time t, you will get an answer and you replace the state instantaneously by the collapsed state. That's an idealization. You're right. An actual physical measurement will, it might be slow, it might be fast, but it will be over, it will be extended to some extent in time. Is that really going to make, I mean, that certainly makes a difference to the details of the discussion, but is it really going to make a difference to the broad point in the end?
You don't have instantaneous, can you?
You don't have instantaneous, but you can have very, very quick.
Additionally, from measurement postulates, the standard interpretation of it, or maybe one interpretation is the decoherence, quantum decoherence, and that essentially says that your measurement will propagate out at the speed of the fastest interaction, which is right now believed to be the speed of light, so you can't, you know, the decoherence will, the bubble of decohering universes will propagate out at the speed of light. And so you don't get any.
Well, no. Okay, so 2 points. I think you've made two different points there. So the first one, I would say we still have a, let's take on board the fact that measurements take a finite time. We still have a potential worry here. They can be very, 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 very fast. This separation can be arbitrarily far. So we can still arrange that a measurement over here is complete before a light ray could have got from here to the place where this measurement starts, and vice versa. We do measure things, we get answers in finite time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can separate things by appreciable fractions of a light second, even on Earth. I totally take the point, and it's good to point out that we've idealized, but it doesn't seem to kill the worry. I think the worry survives.
I'm not sure.
You don't have to. Right now we're sort of exploring questions. We don't have to nail down all the answers at the moment. Let me come back to the decoherence one afterwards, because there's more hands going up. Is one over there? Yep.
No, that's just something to this, is measurement interaction or is it something else point, something that I've never really understood. If measurement is just another form of interaction that takes a finite time span and propagates information causally with only speed of light, it is a kind of process that respects superpositions, respects unitarity. Then the measurement postulate cannot be right, because a projector is definitely not a unitary operator. And so the collapse of the wave function, or whatever it is that mimics the collapse, cannot be a unitary process. It definitely annihilates information of the system. And so what is it, what makes this measurement so special? I mean, this is something that I do not see resolved in decoherence as well. Because you would always have to shift it further and further to bigger and bigger systems, and you do not get rid of the problem that somehow an observer or observing entity or observing being or whatever decoheres it. And this is a very hard way of doing physics.
Right.
If you always agree.
Thank you very much for that. I think what you've articulated is one important line of thought about the measurement problem, what's called the measurement problem, or maybe the reality problem is a better. How can we talk about measurements as a fundamental ingredient of one of our fundamental postulates of physics, and at the same time talk about unitary evolution? What tells us a measurement has taken place? We don't seem to have a definition of it. We sort of know one when we see one, but you. On this line of thought, at least, you expect something more than that from a from fundamental physics theory. You expect a mathematical characterization. You expect to be able to plug everything into the equations and say, aha, so that was a measurement. That would at least be one resolution. Another resolution would be, there's something sick here. We have two different evolution laws. We have the unitarity and we have the measurement postulate. Something's got to give. Maybe, and another line of thought would say, the unitarity wins. The measurement postulate is, maybe it's some sort of effective rule or something that we find convenient to use, but it's fundamentally disposable. Perhaps we should try and make sense of quantum theory with pure unitary evolution. That line of thought leads you towards Everett's ideas on quantum theory. It leads you towards Manyworth quantum theory. And maybe there's time we'll touch on both that, articulating that, and some of the problems with it at the end of this course. Certainly, I'd be very happy to talk about it offline. Let's try and gather our thoughts here. There's an awful lot to be said about how fundamentally we could interpret, make sense of, understand quantum theory. I want to encourage you to think about that to some extent, but I also don't want to turn this into a purely quantum foundational course. So at some points we're going to just have to notice there are problems here, things that are worth thinking about, but accept that there's at least one standard line of thought and one standard line of calculation that we need to understand further mathematically. After all, it's perfectly possible that the mathematics will guide us towards a better answer to some of these problems. It may be that we're at too early a stage, either in looking at an experiment or in looking at the mathematics, to be able to get a definite answer. I hope that doesn't sound evasive. I mean, I totally agree. I agree with everything you said. I totally agree with the spirit of the question. But we're not. We could spend 15 lectures just trying to resolve that, and I don't think we, even in this classroom, reach consensus if we did. So I'll come back to it, and I'm very happy to talk more about it offline. Were there more questions at the moment? Yeah.
Just comment. In fact, Rob Speckens will do that. He'll spend 15 lectures.
Thank you for stressing that. Yeah. So there's a quantum foundations course which takes place sometime in January. Where all the foundational and conceptual issues of quantum theory are investigated in a great deal of detail, and by Rob, who's one of the masters of quantum foundations and has an extraordinary ability to articulate all the possible views and stress, capture both their why they seem compelling to some people and why they seem problematic to others. So if you're interested, I would very strongly recommend that. More generally, Perimeter is a place where lots of people have thought and are thinking about such questions. And you have a year here. You should use it to talk to such people and try and learn more about what they're thinking and what they think the answers might be. We're slightly overrunning, but would it be okay for me to use another 8 minutes? Does anybody? Okay, let's continue then. Okay, I want to be sure that we're agreed about what nature is telling us about some of these puzzles. And so I wanted to focus quickly on the famous double slit experiment. Let me just cut to the chase for the moment. Here is a video.
Now we are looking at the detector tails of monitor. Right. The,
I'll stop. Stop this just for a moment. This is a video that you could find on the Hitachi website site of an experiment of electron interferometry done by Tonemura and collaborators. Let me first give you the diagram of the experiment. And turn the lights down, thank you. Let me see if I can find that diagram. I'll come back to it. Let me. Very, very roughly, what's happening here is that electrons are being emitted at a source. They're going through a thing called a biprism, and we don't really need to know about it, except that effectively there's no path through this center thing here, and there's no path here. But it's possible to fire an electron through this side, and it's possible to fire an electron through this side. And there's always a problem here. I mean, I'm falling into the almost unavoidable problem that I'm using classical language to describe a quantum experiment. So we have a source. We have the possibility of electrons going that way or that way. But of course, quantum theory tells us there's more possibilities, and maybe we should analyze this in terms of the Schrodinger equation. And then we have a detector screen here, which, when it's hit by an electron, produces a spot. And this experiment, and this is a crucial thing, this experiment is set up so that at any given time, there's at most one electron, almost always, at most one electron actually in the experiment. They're coming out basically one by one. This one comes out, hits the screen, makes a spot, and now it's gone. And now, after some time elapses, another one comes out, hits the screen, makes a spot. So let's just
go here, here and there. So this would indicate individual electrons. Electrons are sent out only occasionally. Therefore, the chance of finding one electron is
And despite that, we see cumulatively a pattern of bright fringe, dark fringe, bright fringe, dark fringe, and so on. So what could what What could explain that? Well, one's first thought is to sort of analyze this in a quasi-classical way. You say, well, okay, the electron either went through the first gap or the second gap. We don't know which. We didn't look to see which. But we could run the experiment with this gap closed, and then we get some distribution on the screen. Obviously, we don't expect it to be the same as that, but something. Maybe it's, well, who knows? We'd have to do the experiment to find out. We could do it with this gap closed, and then we get some other distribution. And if that reasoning, if classical reasoning were valid, since the electron either went through one or the other, the distribution we actually see when both gaps are open ought to be the sum of these two distributions. I think you probably know the punchline. Here, this is a different experiment, a photon experiment, but again with the double slit array. So here is the single slit distribution, and real experimental data is a little bit messier than one might expect. So you do actually see something a little odd. There's slight bright patches there, but basically we have a central area where we find the thing, and the second slit is shifted slightly from that. So if classical reasoning were correct, this plus something a little bit shifted from this ought to sum to this. And it's transparently clear that fails. So we don't find sum of single slit outcomes equals the double slit outcome. We could start to worry about that sort of conceptually. We'd start to worry about why classical reasoning has failed. But we could at least approach it analytically before we go any further and say, well, we already have the Schrödinger equation. We could at least analyze what the Schrödinger equation tells us about this situation. And to do that, we'd need some way of modeling this by potential. So I would suggest something like this, that you have a, if I could sort of draw this as a wall in 1D, you have an effectively infinite potential, and then it goes down to zero in the regions that you can go through, and then it's effectively infinite again, and zero and infinite. And sorry, this potential is supposed to be coming at right angles to the board. So this is VU of Y, this is Y, this is infinity, this is zero, infinity, zero, infinity, zero. And now we could fire something like a Gaussian wave packet at a potential like this, and see what the solution looks like. Okay, so there goes our packet. Heads towards the barrier. This is mod size squared being graphed, so yellow is high and red is intermediate and blue is low. And we see, just as we got scattering off the step potential, that we get some transmitted component that's coming through here and some reflected component that's going backwards. And that's really about as far as it's going to get. Let's see if we can just encourage it to stop there. Okay, well, we weren't really looking at what happens behind the screen. Maybe there's all sorts of interesting stuff, but we didn't have any detectors there. Presumably it's the case, indeed, that we fire electrons at something like this. A lot of the time they'll either bounce back or be absorbed. But we're interested in the ones that get through. So we're really interested in this side of the screen. And what we see if we model the Schrödinger equation numerically is indeed a pattern of high probability, low probability, high, low, high, low, high, low. We see interference fringes. So our worry isn't that experiment is contradicting Schrödinger equation. At least at this sort of qualitative level, we're getting a consistent story from both experiment and the Schrödinger equation. If we have a worry at all, and this is another one of these questions where you have to work a little bit to articulate your worries, it's what could really explain this strange experiment? What's actually going on inside it? How do we get past what I think for many people at least starts out as a powerful intuition that you really should be able to model the double slit outcome as a sum of the two single slits? And how can we probe this? If we want to find out what's going on in an experiment, why don't we look? What happens if we try and test directly, experimentally, what's happening in the interior? For instance, by putting a measuring device over one slit or different measuring devices over both slits. I think probably I should stop here for now. I want, once again, to spend just a little time pointing out the sort of conceptual puzzle that the experiment probes. Maybe more to press forward and try and think what it actually teaches us in terms of different ways of thinking about quantum theory. Quantum theory gets this right. Whatever other conceptual worries we have about what's going on in the experiment, they seem to be leading us in the wrong direction. And we should be guided by nature. Yeah, we should be guided by experiment. So the problem is that modeling the Schrödinger equation numerically maybe isn't giving us a very elegant insight into what's going on. And it turns out that there are conceptually different ways of thinking about a quantum description of this experiment that are more, in some context, more powerful, give, I think it's fair to say, more insight into quantum description of the experiment itself, and more than that, lead us in the end, or at least point us in the direction of a whole new way of thinking about quantum mechanics and quantum field theory that will turn out to be not merely conceptually, but calculationally extremely important. So let's stop there for today. It's been a bit of a trek, but thank you for your patience. If anybody has any questions, does anybody have any quick question here? Otherwise, feel free to come up to me afterwards or come and find me in my office, which is on the third floor. I'm very happy to talk more.